Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's March 2018. Just as I was coming out of the house, Anna said to me, "Why don't you do a podcast on guilt?" And consequently, I've been mulling the topic over as I was coming down the road. It's actually a good topic. It's an interesting one, and I think that we've mentioned it a few times since we've been doing these podcasts. I'm not even sure now off the top of my head if there is one way back. And things are certainly reaching the point now where I'm definitely repeating myself. Anyway, I'm going to give it a whirl. And the question that jumps out at me on this one is, well, is guilt or conscience a matter of something which is inborn, given, already present in human beings, or is it manufactured through social conditioning, education, child rearing, and so forth? Or maybe is it something else? Or is it some combination of these things? Now, if you follow Freud and Nietzsche, and I think Freud actually to some extent follows Nietzsche in this respect, you might take the view that guilt is largely manufactured through child rearing and so forth, and enculturation. If you follow Kant, and probably certain religionists, you'll regard conscience, the faculty for feeling guilt, as being, to quote Kant, the voice of God in man. In other words, guilt is a given. Our capacity for guilt is a given. There's actually something to be said for both of these takes on guilt. And realistically, you're probably not going to unentangle them completely. My own thought about this is that there is a given, hardwired capacity for guilt, and particularly capacity for empathy and guilt upon going against one's empathic feelings. Right. And a view like this comes about when you consider the human beings under the rubric of animalitas and a kind of social Darwinism and all the rest of it. I mean, I believe that those kind of approaches, if overdrawn, don't really work. And read into some rather nasty politics. So we have to be careful, but nevertheless, we know that there's a fierce protective instinct on the part of parents for their children, and ethical impulses, and guilt at failing to live up to those impulses is at that level sort of hardwired and built in. Now we know human beings are very varied. And we know that some people just don't have anything like that. They have no capacity for guilt whatsoever. And in our days, this is classed as a mental disorder or a personality disorder. Psychopathy being the, I think by now, rather old-fashioned name. But certainly, you know, there are personality disorders in the classification system of the DSM, which talk about people who are attenuated or entirely absent sense of conscience and who cannot be made to feel guilty for doing horrible things to other people. I think a lot of these classifications are pretty suspect. They are made up, but they're not about nothing either. I mean, I do take the view that the DSM is, its main function is normative. Yeah. Smoking pot in a country where it's illegal is enough to have you classified as a having a, I don't know, sociopathic personality disorder or something like that. And it's pretty much a tick box mentality that operates within psychiatry, where these definitions, so-called, of personality disorders or mental illnesses come into play. So what I am saying there, that yes, there is something innate. Nevertheless, it is a raw and malleable something that is innate. And as we know, human beings live in societies and are moulded by culture. And the ethics that cultures inculcate into their citizens are very varied. A Spartan might, for instance, feel guilty about not killing a disabled child, whereas in the modern West, even the thought could throw you into paroxysms of guilt. I mean, it's simply comparing the differences between the ethical notions of various cultures over time and across geography is enough to convince one that guilt, the capacity for guilt particularly, is manufactured and structured. And adding weight to their argument would be a glance at the expense and effort and care that's given to the raising of infants and the production of citizens through education, child rearing practices, cultural customs, and so on. So I kind of think there is something there, but a big proportion of what's going on when people feel guilty is cultural, and it's to do with what the individual feeling the guilt has been subjected to in infanthood, in childhood, and continues to be subjected to in terms of the ethical discourses of the society in which they live. Now, Freud and Nietzsche both took issue with Kant's idea of the voice of God in man and thought that conscience was produced by a process and by a social process. In the case of Nietzsche, I'd refer you to one of Nietzsche's most readable books, which is called On the Genealogy of Morals, or some people translate, On the Genealogy of Morality, or even On the Genealogy of Moralities, various translations of the title. And Nietzsche gives quite a lot of space over to considering bad conscience, or guilt, you might say. And Nietzsche does point out that different social classes, let alone different nations, different tribes, will produce different moral systems which they hold their members to. And he even goes so far as to say that tensions within class societies can even themselves be productive of the shape and the flavour of the moral systems that the various classes devise for themselves. So it's a nuanced picture that he gives of the genealogy of morality, of which the capacity to feel guilt is the chief feature. Nietzsche relates guilt to debt. On the basis that the old German words are the same, or Schuld, Schulden, means about debt and sins, and guilt. We have a complex of meanings in which debt in some way is equated with guilt. And we've got this in English too, not to the same extent, but we still speak of somebody who's done a prison term for breaking the law as having discharged their debt to society, having paid their debt to society. We do see it in that way. And of course in the 19th century, you could go to jail for debt and not being able to pay off your debt. You would be punished for debt, just as you would be punished for being found guilty of crime. And in those days, they had, certainly in the UK, I think they had such fun things as treadmills for debtors, where they could just aimlessly expend energy going around on a treadmill. So Nietzsche has hit upon some kind of a connection there, very transparent in the German language, but pretty obvious, I would say, in most places. Nietzsche observes, however, that unless citizens have been subjugated to a certain process, a certain educative process, that they won't have a very strong sense of guilt. And in Nietzsche's imaginary class society, where there's a master class and a slave class, the masters don't undergo processes that inculcate them with guilt, because they have to be ruthless. It's a warrior caste to be ruthless. They take joy in cruelty and just violent expression, rather like the Vikings, if you listen to an earlier podcast. Whereas the slave class does need to behave, and so the processes are more evident there. And the process generally involves, according to Nietzsche, what he calls mnemotechnics of pain. It involves some kind of torture of children, some painful initiation, or some ongoing punitive regime that makes sure that a sense of guilt is inculcated. And in a sense, what guilt does is it internalises punishment, so that society doesn't need to keep punishing you every time you're naughty, every time you do something that endangers the integrity of a social structure. Rather than sending the police round or having you whipped in the market square, that you punish yourself. This is far more efficient. And this is the whole point of guilt, of inculcating guilt, so that people will self-regulate in the interest of society. And that is why it's the inculcation of the faculty for feeling guilt is a social process. This is why we have socialised education and so on. So there's a certain pain involved, a certain training, certain asceticism. Nietzsche also relates this, and I've mentioned this quite a few times before, to the ability to keep promises. And Nietzsche points out that, the ability to keep promises is what enables commercial life to go on. Trade, exchange, economy. We wouldn't have an economy if people didn't strike deals and keep to contracts and keep to promises. If you look at a £20 note, it says on it, "I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of." A pound note, a £10 note, a £50 note is a promissory note. And if you don't pay, of course, you're in debt. And you see that if you're in debt when the debt isn't agreed, that you've broken a promise. And therefore you're guilty. And the whole thing of people being able to keep promises, we train children to keep promises, is so that the economy will function. But left to their own devices, people won't behave like this. They will maybe have a strong protective instinct, which does have an ethical character for their children and their grandchildren, and maybe their immediate group or tribe. But they won't do anything as sophisticated as borrowing money, promising to repay in order to do trade and commerce. I refer you to The Merchant of Venice, actually, to see how this plays out in this dramatic format. And I do think he's onto something. With this picture he gives of guilt and guilt's role in morality, and morality's role in social order, social organisation, and even the economy. Seems strange, but there is a Nietzschean economics sort of implied in this work on guilt and debt and promising. Another thing that Nietzsche points out is the relationship of guilt to religion. Nietzsche takes it that the original religions were sacrificial religions. And again, this was to do with debt. Now, in our imaginary tribe, the members of the tribe feel an immense debt to their ancestors. Because after all, their ancestors gave them the wherewithal to survive. A boy learns from his father and his grandfather how to shoot an arrow and how to catch a rabbit, which will feed the family. And that grandfather and father in turn learn from their grandfather and father, and in turn from their grandfather. So there's a debt to the ancestors for the useful knowledge and the customs and the culture that is handed down, and which ensures the continuity of the tribe. And this is felt as a debt. And therefore, some repayment needs to be made for the debt. And this is the origin of sacrifice. And of course, there is also the idea that the ancestors might get annoyed if they don't have their debt honoured, and will perhaps punish. So there's that angle in sacrificial religion, ancestor worship religion as well. Some members of the tribe sacrifice to the ancestors because they feel guilty if they don't, and because they also feel afraid that they'll be punished if they don't. And again, this is all the stuff that gets eventually over time internalised and perhaps eventually over time less reliant on externalising it with actual real sacrifices. With monotheism, what has happened, according to Nietzsche, is that all of the ancestors have been rolled into one big ancestor. There's the one big daddy, Yahweh. And as we know, this is if you read the Old Testament, a punitive God, and a God who demands sacrifice. Christianity's masterstroke, according to Nietzsche, was to realise that the debt is unpayable. It's a bit like the modern West, where the debt owed by the developed nations, both personal debt and government debt, is far in excess of the actual currency in circulation. It can never be paid. Similarly, it can never be paid. By the time Christianity comes along, people are realising the debt can never be paid. We are too guilty. We are too sinful. And the masterstroke of Christianity is to get God to repay the debt with suffering himself. It's almost like it's a jubilee, it's a write-off of the debt. So it's start from scratch. Or if you say it's the forgiveness of sins, it's basically the same as a write-off of the debt. And God does it himself. And this is a bit like the World Bank saying, OK, we'll forget it. And we'll take the pain, we'll take the hit. Or the Son of God, an aspect of God, will be crucified and will suffer. Anyway, it's interesting, say the least. But certainly, without buying into all the nuances of the story, I think we do have to realise that the monotheistic religions, at least, are very much tangled up with a debt economy, you might call it, or a sin economy, or a guilt economy. For Freud, and in this is like Nietzsche, there is a process that leads to the development in ordinary civilised adults of a superego, which is a posh word for a conscience, an internalised policeman, an internalised moral sense that has capacities to punish when the demands of morality are not met. And the punishment is a feeling of guilt. And feelings of guilt, ongoing, are actually really rather depressing. And do put a blight on life. So this is a story in the same vein as Nietzsche's. The details of the story are rather different, and Freud sees, certainly in male Viennese, Middle European citizens, a process of resolving the Oedipal complex, in which a little boy is in competition with his father for the sexual favours of the mother, in some kind of very primitive way, obviously. And that the complex is resolved when the boy renounces his mother under the threat of castration by his father and submits to the father's law and then becomes like a male in the sub-tribe of males within the society and finds his own wife and all the rest of it. And in the process, the whole guilt apparatus is internalised. Superego is built up out of that process. I think Freud tells this story in several ways. It's rather fanciful, perhaps. But nevertheless, the key point, which I don't think there's any problem about, is that guilt is produced by an educative child-rearing process, and there's an agent of guilt, internalised guilt, which Freud calls a superego. Now we have to bear in mind Freud told this story and retold it, came up with various answers and used various models for understanding the human being. The one I find the most useful is that which sees the finished product of these processes of guilt and conscience inculcation as being a tripartite division within the personality of the human being, within the psyche, of the human being, in which we have the ego, which deals with reality. Its job is to deal with reality, and particularly social reality, is to be able to master the niceties of social interaction, and which also has the function of producing a sense of self, sense of being a separate unit in society that will answer to a name, a whole kind of sense of being individual, sense of boundary, and it deals with reality. The id, the unconscious, where we kind of put all the tacky stuff, and instinct particularly. So all that animal desire to have sex all the time and all the rest of it gets shoved down in there. It's a bit like a kind of a cellar for the stuff we don't want to recognise, which at the same time, or which society is not that keen on allowing, but which at the same time does strive to express itself. So there's upward pressure from the id on the ego. So the id might be saying to the ego, there's an attractive woman, seduce her now. The superego, which is this inculcated conscience, will be turning around and saying, if you take any notice of that, you're going to be in serious trouble. Not only that, I'm going to punish you right now for even thinking it, with feelings of guilt and depression. So you get this kind of tripartite and quite fraught and conflicted interaction on this Freudian picture. And many of the ills of civilization, or in Freud's terms, the discontents of civilization, are due to this. And there is a price, according to Freud, for civilized living, that we repress the id and have a super ego which makes sure the id is repressed by being able to punish with feelings of guilt. And an ego that's got to manage all this and bring it into accord with the prevailing external reality and the demands of society as they're made upon one from the outside, with laws and customs and all the rest of it. I mean, that's outlined in Freud's late book, Civilization and Its Discontents. The tripartite model of the human being is found in a paper which I think is from around about 1932, 33, I think. Might have gone into English in 33. Do actually forget the title. And I'll look it up when I get back and put it in the write-up. So it's quite late also, and I think it's one of Freud's most elegant formulations, and I think in the light of lived experience, it's not a bad descriptive picture that helps us to get our head round a number of sort of fairly common dilemmas. So, where are we up to now? So I've drawn a distinction between accounts of guilt and conscience, if you like, which say that it's purely a matter of the given, and this would be the Kantian notion. Conscience is the voice of God in man. If we feel guilty, it's because we've displeased God. Over and against accounts like Freud's and Nietzsche's, which I've sketched roughly, which propose that conscience, and in other words, the ability to feel guilt, is something which is socially produced in quite a complex way. So just to elaborate on some of the ramifications of that distinction, if you go wholeheartedly along with Kant, you are going to take religion as a given, almost. Kant's formulation puts religion out of the question of our conscience and our guilt and our ethical sense. It's just there. It's just there to represent in society that voice of God in man. There's not a question around it. Where is the Freudian and Nietzschean accounts? Basically just contradict religion. Because religion more or less goes along with Kant. Even whilst religion, of course, is the home of those practices which do inculcate guilt into children. So in that sense, it just comes down to sort of quite a big question. The truth of religion, and the role of religion in social organisation, and the role of religion, or if you like, or the absence of religion in the socialisation of children. Big questions. As I said, my own view is that I do think we do have to have a little consideration of our moral sense under our animalitas, and that there is a sort of a basic root empathy that is to do with biology, but that this is easily overlaid, perverted, and changed and reversed according to the needs of particular societies and according to the narratives and discourses with which the education class or the priestly class within those societies is operating. And ironically, it is possible in the name of religion to reverse that animal given empathy, that animal given ethical sense, with stories, with practices, child rearing practices, with mnemotechnics of pain, to produce citizens that will ignore that kind of raw human impulse to have empathy for others and to care for others rather than destroy them. And at times we find religious discourses and nationalist discourses and cosmological discourses that justify in as transcendental a manner as they possibly can the excising of that animal moral sense so that a nation or a tribe can be militarised and that they will kill others without remorse and torture others without remorse. But this is almost always the result of a process. Naturally, there are a few people who are wired a bit differently, but putting that on one side, if you want a ruthless military caste, you do need to actually produce that. You do need to knock the sympathy out of people to do that. So I do think there is a sort of innate, raw, primitive empathy or ethical sense, but enormous effort goes into layering something on the top of that. And I think both the Freudian and the Nietzschean accounts of those processes are actually quite cogent and certainly worth looking into. I've only sketched them here. It's all I can do off the top of my head, walking down the canal on a Sunday afternoon. Now, some people say society must inculcate the capacity for guilt into children. Otherwise we wouldn't function, we'd have the war of all against all. We're just evil without it. And I suppose this is the idea of original sin. We're just evil without the mnemotechnics of pain to civilise us, even though the price is high and we become depressed people and devitalised people. Now, I do take the view that a good society, certainly a society that I'd like to live in, really doesn't subject children to too much pressure, rather than moulding them into an arbitrary shape that are allowed to find their own way, and that finding of their way is facilitated greatly and with great care. That's my desideratum. I suppose that makes me a snowflake or some shit like that, but there you go. I would prefer it. And I don't actually think that the price for a very strong conscience is that worth paying. And actually, you know, people with the strongest conscience are very often the most saintly people. And saints never put a foot wrong. They're just good to everybody all the time, a rat with guilt. And this, because this is how the process works. And also we have to bear in mind that society does actually have a need and a function for people who don't have too much of that. I mean, it's a truism that business leaders and top politicians are all psychopaths. They don't have much of a capacity for guilt. So this kind of social organisation needs both to inculcate guilt and in some ways encourage, nurture those without it. Now it strikes me, just in the light of this little aside, that if people are loving, if they've got love, that old hippie desiderata, they don't actually need a strong conscience. And they don't really need to feel guilty. They're just good to other people, and because they are. That's it, spontaneous, no question, no wrestling, no agony, no existential turmoil around guilt. So I suppose where you stand on this kind of a question is whether you think it's possible or not. And we've been in the guilt economy for so long, for so many thousands of years, that it's hard to see outside of it. It's hard to imagine that there is anything outside of it. It does look like a given. It does seem as though the world is constructed as Kant says it is, and as the religionists say that it is. And that we do need to torture children, otherwise original sin will take over and it'll be the war of all against all. Personally, I don't buy it, and I've got reasons for not buying it. And maybe that's the theme of another talk. Anyway, I'm almost at Broad Street. It's just 100 yards down there. Remember to do your homework and read the books that I've mentioned. Thank you for listening. Speak to you soon.